Okay, friends, this is Armand DeMille back with you. Share a story with you. The other day I was walking past 2nd Avenue and 81st Street, and there was 300 people lined around a block, lined up for something at the Comedy Central. So I asked them what they were looking for and what they were there for, and they said they were there for auditions. And I looked, down this line of very, very diverse people, and I realized one thing. They were auditioning for comedy. Everybody on this show, everybody on this line thought they were funny, have been told they were funny. So these were all amateurs trying to get, they were going to audition, but they all thought they were funny and have been told by somebody that they made them laugh. Think about that story as it relates to the what you're hearing about narcissism and your image of yourself. What if your image of yourself is you can make people laugh and make them feel good? What if that's your image? I'm going to now turn you back to the tape number 2 of this series, which we are converting to CD for your convenience. You have to tolerate some of the engineering mishaps in this conversion, but I know it's worth it. Everybody, this is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. on WBAI. Today we're going to continue to look at the underpinnings of most people's distress from a point of view that's made a big difference to me in my work as a psychotherapist and in my personal life as well, and I hope to you as well. I call this the drama of the gifted child, with deference to Dr. Alice Miller, a noted psychiatrist who coined the phrase as the title of her book. The title is exactly as it seems. What happens to that child who seems gifted with talents or abilities that are extraordinary? The extra smart or extra creative child. Now, it wouldn't make sense to me that most of the WBAI listeners are those kind of people, you know, and your children are probably gifted as well. How our parents handled our gift, how we handled our own gift, and how we handle our children's giftedness becomes very important. The idea here is to get a handle on three important aspects of human life: narcissism, depression, and grandiosity. Very serious stuff, but not so serious. The three, according to Dr. Miller, and I agree completely, are intertwined. Narcissism, depression, and grandiosity. Three very big words, three very big concepts, very valuable understanding, and certainly worth considering. But I couldn't imagine rushing through it, so I'm covering one part every week, and if you missed last week's show, the tape recording is available by calling my office. I'll give that number later. Last week, I also talked to you about my personal drama related to these subjects, and from your responses, you seemed to enjoy the story. And last week, I told you that about my series of jokes that I told at lectures and workshops. I told you I had 5 favorite jokes, and I told one of them, today you get the second joke, which has to do with our subject. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. We're talking about grandiosity, narcissism, and depression, and how it relates to our day-to-day existence, how it relates to our feeling of success and failure. Last week, we covered the trappings of success and spoke with a few of you who I hope to get back on the air today. But before I do, I want to explain to you so that you can follow me on this journey. And I wanted to start off with a definition. Here's a psychological concept that has become one of the favorite subjects in psychiatry for the last 20 years. People have got a different interpretation, but here's mine. I'm talking about the concept called narcissism. Now, let me say it again. Narcissism. Not narcissism, like many people say. Like men say prostate gland, you know, and it's really the prostate gland, but men often wind up in a prostrate position because of their glands, or maybe it's not such a mistake after all. Well, that's besides the point. Narcissism. Big word, three syllables, used as a descriptive word. Narcissism. Not narcissistic. Narcissistic. Well, the word's going to float around here for the next few weeks, so let's get it straight, okay? Oh, didn't I teach that well? Don't you love me for teaching the pronunciation of a word? Well, that's what it's all about. I'm betting that if you get a handle on this subject, if you understand your own narcissism and other people's narcissism and my narcissism, and you really understand it, not to judge it or criticize yourself or other people, but really understand the dynamics of it, you'll live a happier, more positive life. And so will your children and their children. So what is narcissism? It's not what most of you think. Narcissism is not self-love. That's the way it's used, but that's not what it means. I mean, that's what it means if you use it that way, but that's not the way I mean when I use it. And that's not the way most clinicians mean when they use narcissism. Which reminds me, I promised to tell you the joke, which relates to the subject. And these are stories that I carry around in my lecture circuit, you know, and I always try to lighten the mood a little. And this one relates to how we are used to seeing things and our topic of the narcissistic self. This is, whenever I get a crowd that seems to be stuck in their ways and perceptions, I tell them about the time that Pablo Picasso met up with Edward Steichen, the great photographer. And according to the story, Steichen challenges Picasso in front of a small group of people. He asks, "Why do you paint people in such a distorted manner?" Well, Picasso responds, "They're not distortions." Steichen looks and says, "What do you mean, not distortions? They don't look like real people." And Picasso says, "They look real to me." So Steichen gets really heated, you know. "When I take a photograph, you can see an image of exactly how a person is." And Picasso responds, "When I paint a picture, you see exactly what the person is." Steichen's getting a little out of hand, tries to prove his point, reaches into his pocket and pulls out a 3x5 photograph, holds it up to Picasso and says, "Look! This is my wife." And Picasso looks at this little photograph and says, "Small, isn't she?" So that's story number two. Number three and four come in the following weeks. You'll hear them and understand them all. Let's get back to the subject, narcissism. Narcissism is not self-love. In fact, it's the opposite in a way. Narcissism is like self-loathe more than it is self-love. It's more disdain for the self than it is love for the self. Let me explain. When we're children, we learn that certain behaviors will get us love and others will get us disapproval. If we're good according to the standards and values of our parents and teachers, if we're good, we get loved. And getting loved means a lot to a child. In fact, it means everything. Remember what it was like to get the disapproval? It may be a distant memory for you, but to a child, to have your parent angry or disappointed in you is like the end of the world. Try this one on. "Go to your room." Imagine, remember that was said to you in anger, or someone says it in anger, or a parent says it in anger. What do they think the child's going to do in that room? Every child who was ever sent to his or her room felt bad. Then once they're in the room, what do you think they do? What's the idea? The child is supposed to go to their room until they feel bad enough to act, think, and feel the way the parent wants them to act, think, or feel. You send a child into solitary confinement, often without food, you know, just like in a prison, to think about the consequences of not feeling, thinking, or behaving the way your parents want you to. And what equipment does the child have to really make a decision? The pressure is, "I will dislike you until you become what I want you to be." The child makes one of two decisions. Rarely does a 5-year-old child say to themselves, you know, when they're sent off to their room, "Well, I fully appreciate my family's perceptions, and I want to take responsibility for this disagreement. I've acted in a way that reflects my own internal conflict without consideration for the way that my behaviors impact on those around me, and I truly feel remorseful." That's not what a kid does. It's kind of what the parents expect them to do, but that's not what a kid does. Maybe Freud's children did that, you know? But then again, the children of most psychiatrists usually wind up with the most severe emotional damage. So, no, instead the child makes a decision. "I better make believe that I agree so that I can get out of here." You see? But one day, the kid says to himself, "I'll get even. I'll get so big that they can't tell me what to do." So we try to please our parents. We adapt a personality that is shaped around what pleases and displeases our parents. At first, it may be only an act. You act innocent in front of your parents, and they're shocked when they hear that you were found smoking dope in the basement of the school. So in order to get loved, you realize that you have to be nice or become a caretaker of your brother and sisters, and you try to do that. You learn that certain emotions and feelings, like anger, should be hidden from them. And if you're really unfortunate, you lose all sense of your own identity and become what they want you to be. This is Armand DeMille speaking about the heavy stuff, but trying to give you a handle on what happens to people on their own road to their own idea of what success is. And we're talking about a kind of intricate concept here called narcissism. I'd like you to understand it because I think it would mean a lot to you if you do, and I think it will help you. The self that's developed with the sole purpose of getting love and approval. We start it with our parents, and then we take this personality into the world. Does it work on our friends? Does it work on our teachers? Do they all give me love and approval if I behave in a certain way? That self, the one we adopt to get love and approval in the world, that self is the narcissistic self. What would have happened if we grew up in an environment where love was not conditional? Then we could have just been our own, let our own personality emerge, a real self, not one based on getting love and approval. So narcissism is our attachment to that self which we created to get love and approval from our parents and from all the symbolic parents that we encounter in life, our teachers, our friends, our lovers. I mean, listen to the music out there, you know. Love is all there is. If we only had love, without love, life is not worthwhile. I mean, everybody's kind of validating the world is about love and getting love. Well, it's not true. The world's about a lot of things. Why do you think we're so quick to buy this music? Because unconditional love is almost never present for a child. A child's life is spent trying to get the love out of its parents, and so is, therefore, our adult life. That's why love can bring up such feelings of desperation and abject despair. Because we're looking for that original acceptance and approval. Loving is only one aspect in life, and there's a lot more to life than love. But as children, that's the bind we get caught in. So back to narcissism now. It's exciting because you could actually begin following it in your own life. And we're going to be calling back some of the people who called in the last few days, last week, because I want to try to get them to follow us on the story. Narcissism is the attachment of our love-getting self to our love-getting self. For most of us, the narcissistic self is all we know. And somewhere, somehow, we sense that there's a real self lurking. Someone who's not caught in the endless pursuit of love and acceptance. Somewhere, each of us suspects that our act is kind of a phony. In some way, we don't feel real. For a good reason, because we're not. As Alice Miller described in her book, I'll read what she says, the tragedy is that early psychic injuries and those inevitable repressions which makes a child survive. In a broad sense, it is the tragedy of almost everyone. As children, we strive above all else to accommodate our parents' demands, spoken and unspoken, reasonable and unreasonable. In the process, we blind ourselves to our true needs and feelings. In our adult life, it's like trying to sail a ship without a compass, not knowing who we are, what we feel, and what we need. Even as grown-ups, we remain subject to the expectations we fulfilled. Not for love, but for the illusion of love. Without that illusion, no one could have survived childhood. So the bottom line here is that the trap we fall into as we become adults, especially when we begin to succeed in our own life plan. So before I go any further, I'm going to try something new. Last week, we got a number of callers who told us about the issues related to their success. I asked the callers to call my office and leave their phone numbers and be part of this further exploration about how the narcissistic self often defeats itself in an attempt to reclaim some sense of identity. So I'm going to get some of these people on the line now. You try the first call, Matthew. And I'm going to keep talking about it. Now, I want the people I call, I want you to relate to this idea of being a kid and trying to please your parents. Give me just your background, and then maybe I'll have you back on in the following weeks. So the very first person I'll get on the call is a gifted artist, right, who is very successful in his career and has a lot of conflict about going for the gold, you know, going for the big thing. To give you some idea, about his complexities. I'll let you hear a taste of the music that this man creates. He's a gifted pianist. He's performed in concert. And at my request, he sent me some of his music. Here's a little bit of the inside of the man we're going to talk to. Okay, Joe. You've heard the beginning of the show, and I'm kind of proposing that somewhere in early childhood you formed a personality, a narcissistic personality, one that was developed to please your parents. And it's highly possible that in order for you to really understand the roots of your sometimes self-defeating behavior, you have to go back to the origin of the self. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to don my shrink cap and ask you a little about your origin, you know? Then as I go further with this, I'll get you back on the air maybe next week and see if you can explore some stuff that might make a real difference to you. By the way, before I do, I heard from one listener who said that he used to hate when I played psychotherapist and asked people to go through some intense stuff on the air. He was surprised to learn that I am, in fact, a real live therapist, educated and licensed, and I've been doing this stuff for over 25 years. He thought I was just a radio guy playing God. Well, sir, you're wrong. I'm not just a radio guy playing God. I'm a licensed psychotherapist playing God. I mean, before we go any further, right, before we talk about narcissism, what do you think shrinks become shrinks? Why do you think my profession is so? Where else can you get a captive audience to give you love and approval? Talk about shrinks. What about physicians? If you don't show them affection, they could kill you. I mean, you know, they won't take care of you. And what do you think about it? I mean, they have a way that if you don't love them, I love this for physicians, if you don't love them, if you get angry at them and you tell them you're angry, they have malpractice insurance. They have a thing so they could take anybody who doesn't love them and send them over to somebody else so that the other person will deal with them. That's what malpractice insurance is about. That's why it costs so much money, because those people got to take all the gripes. So the people who get mad at you, right? So the helping profession is staffed by us, narcissistic egos. I mean, what about media broadcasters like me and Matthew and the rest of us on here and BAI trying to get the millions of you to love us? We watch the ratings to find out if we're loved or not. I mean, we don't ask our mothers. Anybody in broadcasting, anybody you've ever heard on radio or saw on TV is presenting their narcissistic personality, actors, actresses, performers, all bent on getting mass approval. So I ask you to travel with me on this road of self-investigation. And let me assure you that in no way do I sit here high and mighty, not touched by these concepts. That's why I took that year off back in 1987, because I realized I was getting wrapped up in my narcissistic image. I wanted to find out where the real Armand was hiding. Best thing I ever did. So back to you, Joe. Mm-hmm. Sorry for that episode, and welcome to WBAI again.
Nice to be here.
Okay, now you've heard a little about what I said, right? Here you are a performer, an achieved performer. I mean, people don't know. They don't know that this was in concert at a well-known hall and that... you're up now, I think, for some position at a university, and you're somebody who's, you know, done it. How does your performing self, as you know it, relate to your trying to please your parents?
It's a little hard for me to really put my finger, you know, on any exact thread. I mean, I could tell you about a little bit about life at home and so on.
Yeah, tell me about you and piano at home.
Well, I was encouraged.
By whom?
To learn piano by both my parents.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I began with some typical suburban music store pop piano lessons.
Uh-huh.
But I gradually discovered that wasn't fulfilling what I needed to do, so I gradually got into some serious music. And
okay, now your parents loved your doing the pop music, right?
Oh, yeah, they enjoyed that.
I mean, were they proud of you? Did they show you off?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
For sure.
So they kind of made a deal with you, Joe. They said, you play this music that people like, and we will love you, right? Or we'll give you love and approval. And you were a good boy. You learned how to play music, and music became your life. Is that true?
Yes. It wasn't quite as blanket a statement as, you know.
Well, make it a little less
blanket. But
make it a little less blanket. Let's put some holes in the blanket. Fill it in.
Well, I remember having approval for my work and encouragement to go ahead with it. I'm not certain that my parents were entirely pleased with the direction I took.
No, 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 and I'm going to get to that, you see. In the beginning, they were approving of you when you played Come to Me, My Melancholy Baby, right? When you could play the pop tunes, they were approving of it, right? And then some part of you, put that back on, Matthew, right? Some part of you, can we do all three? Matthew, some part of you said, right, well, instead of playing that music, I'm going off on my direction. And something in you said, I'm not being filled just playing for my family. But I want to still play. I still feel myself on that road. And some part of you breaks out and says, I need to do music the way that I want to do the music, which is exactly the opposite of what they like. Is that true?
Well, so that's the way it eventually turned out. I mean, there were many years in which I studied strictly classical music.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this of course, was all to their liking. And it wasn't, strictly speaking, popular format music, but
mm-hmm.
within the bounds of...
It was within the bounds of. And then you turned to this other, more creative, more coming-from-you style, right?
Right. Well, it happened that there were a lot of other influences there. I was at a university where contemporary music was a really hot scene in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And, late 60s, and it was really stimulating, and it was then that I knew that this is the direction I wanted to take.
Okay, now the position that you're being offered.
Let's back up a little bit. I think, as I mentioned last week, I had in the past been offered some positions.
Right.
But I never found myself following through on that. I don't know whether it was with the intent to just follow up on the freelance scene in New York and remain in that.
Those positions would have in some way represented that you'd have to abandon the freelance scene, wouldn't it?
Well, yes.
Okay, now let's start there. So here you are tossed back. I mean, you have to pardon my shrink view. Here you are tossed back to, I'm either going to go back to the stuff that pleases, or I'm going to be the person who pleases myself. And you see it as kind of self-defeating that you don't take these positions and abandon the avant-garde freelance style. You know, and I say this is a classic example. He's a perfect example of a man who is in battle between who he is really and who he is just to get love and approval. Does that make any sense to you?
It does, but I should point out that there are many people who manage to carry both, to keep both balls in the air, to have an established position somewhere and you know, travel widely and perform. And
who does keep both balls in the air?
I've known a number of musicians who do it.
And you're married too, aren't you?
Yes, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. How does your wife feel about your music?
Pardon me?
How does your wife feel about your music?
Oh, she's fine with it. She's I've always done it since before the time I met her. So.
And what would she prefer? Which way should you go?
I don't know. She doesn't seem have any desire that I'd do anything different.
Other than what you feel like doing, huh?
No, she's really with me.
You're a really lucky man. So the conflict you have about yourself is you think that you sometimes defeat yourself, don't you?
I certainly do feel that, yes.
Because you don't take the traditional, the path that's a little more secure, and you don't take some of those positions that are offered you, right?
Well, yes, that's part of it.
What's the other part?
Well, I do other things. I put other obstacles in my own way.
Like what?
For about over 10 years, I've had a commitment from a record company to put out a specific CD. And during some of that time, of course, I was working on the music, getting it to a point that I figured it would be ready for recording.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be my fault, maybe not, but it dragged out to a point where the manager of the record company had probably lost interest and didn't want to continue with the project.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one sort of ambiguous area where it might have been at least partially my fault. I'm a little lazy when it comes out to writing promotional letters and sending tapes and...
And promoting yourself and putting...
Self-promotion. A lot of us in New York have that problem, by the way.
Okay. Well, Joe, if you will stick with me for the next few weeks, if you happen to be available, what I'm going to do is continue your story as I collect this story of yours and talk around it, all right?
Sure.
It's a real pleasure being with you. And thanks so much for the tape. I guess there's no way that people could get it because it's not published music, is it?
That isn't... commercially available. That's sort of private tape, I said to people.
Okay. Okay, well, maybe in the future we'll tell people how they might get it if they want it, okay? Thanks for being on the phone. So there we have it. I mean, there we have, I know you might think I'm pushing this a little bit, but there we have the narcissistic ego. There we have this self that has developed to be an outstanding child. And there we have this conflict that appears, you know, going your way or going the way of all flesh, if your family is all flesh. And that's one example. Let me speak to another person now, Diane, who was on with us last week. And Diane, I remember anthropology, right?
Yes.
Hi there. Welcome back.
Thanks.
And I think you spoke about it. You are an anthropologist who finds yourself stuck in completing the last aspect of your work to get a certain amount of recognition.
Yes. I defended my dissertation and successfully, no revisions necessary. But didn't complete the citations on the dissertation and therefore never got a diploma.
And so you never got the diploma. Now, let me ask you, where did your interest in anthropology develop?
Well, I was always interested in people from different cultures and understanding different cultures. And plus, I was interested in women cross-culturally, interested in gender issues.
Who was the most... to encourage you in your education, your mom or your pop?
My mother.
Your mother, right? And she really was kind of proud of your scholastic achievement and your scientific curiosity?
Well, not, I don't know about scientific, but my scholastic achievement, yes, she was.
So your love, or the love that you got from her, was you kind of got a lot more love because you were good in school.
Yes, that's true.
Right? And you followed a path that we're suggesting here may have been motivated, possibly may have been motivated by this desire to maintain her love and approval, right? And this is just theory, okay? We're gonna slide into this over the next couple of weeks. But do you get that idea that the scholastic you, the educated you, the one who is especially, you know, getting the degree and finishing the degree, that would have made Mom real proud?
I'm not sure about that.
Why do you think not?
Competition.
She might have gotten jealous, huh?
I think so, yeah.
So somehow, what you're doing, kind of the way you're saying it is, that you're so set on getting her love and approval that you won't even get the degree because you're afraid you'll lose her love and approval.
Well, it sounds like there might be something to that.
Now, this is kind of the issue. It always sounds like, you know, we're kind of forcing it into the mold. But let's give that a consideration. Let's just take that and consider it, Diane. Let's consider that somehow you are caught in this trap of both, like Joseph too, you know, trying to please, and in your case, you know, trying to hold on to that admiration and love, and you're so attached to it that you think it's the real you. But something gnaws at you. Something says to you, oh, this whole thing that you're doing is kind of silly. This is this whole thing about getting the degree and not getting the degree and going all the way and not going all the way. That whole conflict keeps you embedded in some struggle that doesn't feel absolutely real. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Do you know the part about it's not feeling like it's real life, like it's just some kind of a drama you're in?
I sure do.
Tell me a little bit.
Well, so it preoccupies me a lot. I'm, you know, while I'm going about my outward life, it just gnaws at me, and it's like the albatross of the Ancient Mariner. I can't get it off my back, and it becomes an obsession.
And it's this interesting thing, you know. All of life, for you, Diane, is wrapped up in this drama. Like you said, it's the albatross. And there's got to be more of a Diane somewhere. But you can't stop thinking about it. It's like people in love who can't stop thinking about the person they love and they're attached to, and they can't get it off their mind, and this person is the symbolic person who's supposed to give them love, you know, and when they don't get the love, they worry about it, and they think about them all the time. It's like an albatross. It's like there's a life out there somewhere. And you can't complete this life. You can't have this life because... You can't have this life because it's going to be, you're too wrapped up in the other thing. Whatever real life is, it's not this. Well, this is what I'm going to be addressing, and I'm going to be addressing this over today and next week as well. And if you could be around, I'd like to kind of bring it closer to where we could explore it a little further, but I want you to be sure to hear what I have to say about it. Can you be around next week too?
Yeah.
Well, this is really good. It's really good to talk with you. Let me recommend to you and to Joseph, both of you, if you want to follow me along, the revised version of The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller is a worthy book to pick up so that you can go through this with me, okay? Now, before we take our next caller, which is going to be Ronaldo, we're going to have to take a break. And then when I get back, I'm going to go a lot more into this and to the different directions that this narcissistic life can take you. This is Armand DeMille. Be back with you in just a couple of
minutes. Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind, taking on this kind of difficult task of teaching you about narcissism and how it affects your life. Last week we started off this search of the drama of the gifted child, and this week, a little earlier today, we talked about narcissism, and there's a couple of callers who called in last week that I'm interested in following their stories so we could use it as an example for what we do. I'm going to continue talking about narcissism and showing you some of the way it breaks down into adult life, but before I do, I want to take that earlier part, which was narcissistic self. This artificial self that we develop is a direct response to trying to get the love and approval of our parents, which is, I know it sounds very psychoanalytic, but let's just say it's not, and we'll play it on as real. And I've got on the air with me a caller who called in last week, Ronaldo. Ronaldo, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, I'm glad you're around. Thanks for sticking around and not going to your meeting. You had a big fear of failure.
Yes.
Okay, now from what I said a little earlier, did you hear the show a little earlier?
Yeah, I've been listening to it since it started.
Okay, did it make sense to you?
Yeah, everything was fitting, you know, well into place.
Tell me how it fits into place.
The family plays a big part in it all.
Your family plays a big part in all of this.
And it's sort of, the same thing, trying to play the good guy or trying to fill the role of an absent parent or trying to fill the role of an absent brother or something.
Tell me about yours. Talk about yourself. When you were a kid, you had these different roles?
I guess the role was trying to play father.
Where was your dad?
Working. Second shift all the time. At the same time, my mother was working first shift. She happens to be a psychotherapist also.
Yeah, remember what I said about the kids of the psychotherapists? Do you agree with me?
Yeah. And so it was always on me to take care of my younger brother since I was the older. And, you know, and she would put that on me. This is something that we've gone over, you know, now.
And what would happen?
That, you know, she feels guilty about. So in turn, turned around, I scolded my brother. I punished him when I felt it was necessary. And I beat him when I thought it was necessary. And this was all carried on by someone who was like 8 years old or 12 years old.
You were 8 years old or 12 years old.
Yeah.
Darn. And here you are, frustrated and angry, being told to be something that you're not, being the father, being assigned the role of father, and here your anger comes out, and you turn around, and you wind up beating up on your kid brother in your own way because you're trying to play daddy and what daddy's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And so you get into this thing. Now, did you ever hurt your brother?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really hurt him?
Couple of times, remember one time we were walking with my grandparents who babysitted us at the time. He must have been about 4 and I'm 5 and a half years older, so I was around 9 or 10. So he ran up ahead of us on the street, decided to climb up the fence into our yard, and there was something about that that I didn't approve of. So I picked up a rock and threw it at him. And hit him on the head, and he was hanging by his shirt on the fence, and my grandmother screamed, my grandfather screamed, and my grandfather hid the rock because he didn't want my father to see it. He tried to clean up the blood as much as he could. I don't remember if he ever had to get stitches or anything. But, you know, now I think about it, and I see the scar on his head when he gets his hair cut short enough. And, it's, you know, it's a painful thing.
Do you remember what happened to you the moment that you hit your brother with that rock and you saw that he was hurt? Can you remember what you felt like? Or did you leave town with your mind?
I really can't say. Those years are very fuzzy for me.
And you could remember something about throwing the rock.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can't remember anything, right?
Little parts of it. Little parts of it.
Like what little parts of it?
Like being in the house, and, you know, having that outer body experience kind of thing, watching myself in a corner, waiting for my father to come around.
Okay, now you see that part? There's where it happens to kids. There's an example of where it happens. That's when you lost your mind. You see what I mean? That out-of-body experience for a 9.5-year-old child, afraid that he's done something that is absolutely wrong, waiting for dad to come home, really feeling this kind of dissociated, displaced, horrible, horrible feeling, but at the same time being dead on the inside. That kind of seeing yourself sitting in the corner from a distance. That makes you make a deal with yourself at that moment. And if we had the time, or if I had the time to work with you, or if somebody would work with you, I'd get you right back to that moment and see what decision you made for the rest of your life right then. You have any idea what you said to yourself?
At that moment?
At that moment, yeah.
It's been kind of tough because that was only one little part.
Yeah, I know.
And my dissociative sort of states that I used to get into stemmed from an abuse that I had endured about a year before that incident. So most of my time and energy has been spent on that, you know, on that earlier abuse. So these little things, it's like I remember them and they hurt a lot, but I've been able to let go of them because of, you know, working on my stuff here.
And you've done a lot of work on your stuff, as I hear it. You know, you've really gone a long way. You've had help, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we hear it, and we hear what can happen to a child. Ronaldo, I want to thank you in particular for bringing this up. Now, you asked a question about your fear of failure. You remember that feeling that you had when you realized you made a mistake and you threw that rock and you shouldn't have thrown that rock?
Do I remember?
I mean, you don't remember it, but I mean, you could look back and see how terrified you must have been.
Yeah.
And how terrified you must have been of your father coming home and the consequences for that mistake. I could imagine that following that, you would have a tremendous fear of making mistakes.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. That's something that's plagued me throughout my life.
And plagues you through today, even though I hear you're kind of successful in what you do now, huh?
Plagued me, and then also, it's a duality there. The good and the bad out of something that manifested out of childhood. You know, it came out of something bad, and then now you experience that there's good in this, and then there's also bad in it. And then the bad is that, yes, I'm terribly afraid, and, you know, I'm my worst enemy when I try to get something done. But yet, I will double-check myself so much instead of being caught, you know, not having done everything I was supposed to, that I always look like, wow, you know, he's really on top of the ball and so forth. So
you're kind of caught in this drama that makes for an effective life, but not a happy life.
Not all the time, no.
Yeah. I hear. So, Ronaldo, if you will, you know, I hope you're around for the next couple of weeks. I'm going to go back to your example and relate it to what we're talking about, because this is a perfect example of where we're going. Okay with you?
All right, great.
I really thank you for sharing it with us, because your story, I'm sure, touches all of our hearts.
All right.
And to your mom, who turned around and realized it at some point, what did I do to my child, you know? What did I do to my child, you know? My sympathy goes to her as well, for her realization, and her at least trying to make the amends that go along with it.
Yeah.
Do you forgive her?
Oh, yeah. It's a growing process for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling.
All right.
This is Armand DeMille. As you can see, the self that we develop to deal with our parents' conditional love, like Ronaldo, you know, going to be the daddy of everybody, becomes the only self we know. And there's a part of us that cries out for us to become real. It's like being a snake who sheds its skin every year. The narcissistic self is that dead snake skin that covers the snake that's about to molt. You know, it's still on your body, it looks like your real skin, but it's skin to be eventually shed so that the real self can emerge from underneath. But people only see that dead skin and they think it's you. So how many directions can the narcissistic self take in life? Now, there's a very interesting question which we'll cover in more detail next week when we have the show. But according to Alice Miller, once you get stuck, as most of us do, in spending your life in search of love and approval, you could go one of two ways. She had it nice and simple, you know, two directions only. You can either become grandiose or you could become depressed. And she basically says everybody out there caught in the narcissistic struggle is either grandiose or depressed. Grandiose, you know what that word means? You know, like showy, splashy, visible, out there, you know, reaching out to people. According to Alice Miller, the person who is grandiose is admired and needs this admiration. He or she cannot live without it. The grandiose person must excel in whatever they do, and they don't, or they don't even try to do things, you know what I mean? They're going to, we're going to go much further into this next week, but the bottom line here is that a grandiose person believed that they could get loved if they put themselves out there. Now that's one type. The other possible development in the drama of the gifted child with this narcissistic self is that they give up trying to get loved. They don't believe that they could get loved under any circumstances. And since they give up, they won't become grandiose because they don't believe they could get love, and they learned in childhood that love was not available, that they weren't capable of doing that which gives them love, those people become depressed. So according to Alice Miller, you either become grandiose or depressed. Now, everybody on radio who's broadcasting on radio is grandiose. Everybody who's a performer is grandiose, right? Everybody who's out there trying to succeed and putting themselves out there in the world, those are the grandiose people. And the people who stay home, the people who are bitter, the people who are angry, silently angry, those are the depressed ones. So a depressed person is one who believes that they can never find the love that they need. And a grandiose person is one who believes that they can find the love that they need through admiration. So there you have it. Two basic adaptations to a childhood of conditional love. And it sounds pretty tragic. Well, in a way it is, but not more tragic than the rest of nature, because it's kind of like all of nature. Here we are born with a certain condition that leaves us dependent on our parents in one form or another. And we have an opportunity to break away from it at some point in our lives. Everybody gets a chance to grow up, even now. Even Ronaldo. And certainly he's trying. So here's the rule of the game. If you spend most of your life trying to shore up that narcissistic skin, trying to keep getting love and approval, or giving it up and getting depressed, if you spend your life either live depressed or grandiose, but then each of us get your chance to get your own 1987, you know, your own moment. Each of you have a day, or every day, have a chance to slip out of that skin and become your own person. Each of you have a chance to examine, what am I doing here? Whose love am I trying to get? To ask yourself the question, sometimes stop. And what happens over time as you get older, or should I say, chronologically advantaged? Good phrase. If you care less and less about living for other people, and you're lucky, you take one of those moments or one of those times to examine your life and see, how can you become your own person rather than keeping on the narcissistic merry-go-round? One letter I got this week came from a psychologist who said, you know, a lot of the people we work with, you shared with us your presentation about your own life in 1987. When you had the wherewithal or the means to stop for a period of time and get to know yourself. She said, and a lot of our people hear that, but they don't have the financial condition to do that. Well, there are things you could stop. You don't have to stop everything. Stop working and stop everything and start doing what you do to get by in life. But there are things you could look at that you're saying, I'm only trying to feel better through trying to get somebody's approval. Those are the things you look at. And we'll be talking more about that next week and some of the other options. Next week, I'm also going to go further into the concept of the drama of the gifted child, and I'll focus more on three aspects. You know, the grandiosity, the depression, and a thing called the narcissistic wound, which once you understand that, you'll understand why people who are very excited and happy suddenly can become very depressed. But before we do, if there's anybody else out there who is listening to this show, who is related to this subject, let's try to get a couple of more of you callers on the air, 279-3400. This is Armand DeMille. You've been listening to A Mouthful today. Let's hear from you, 279-3400. We've got a few callers immediately. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Wyatt from Jersey City.
Wyatt?
How you doing?
Hi there.
I happen to be home at lunch. I got to get back to work. But I was listening to the show, and I do recall in my growing up and adolescence, I relate to some of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite touching in a way.
In what way?
Whereby in the family, growing up with six of us, and just relating to the stories, I just wanted to say.
What did you? I mean, imagine with six of you there, how you were trying to get the love and approval. What position did you adapt? You know, what did you do to become a pleaser?
Well, I had to fight with all six of us, and actually, I'm a bit nervous on the air, so I'm just trying to collect my thoughts.
Okay, take your time.
Let's see. Well, when I was growing up, I was very quiet. Now I'm not, so.
Mm-hmm. Was being quiet what your family valued? Was there too much noise in the house?
No, it was a lot of noise, but deciphering through, you know, what I wanted, I was always quiet. My mother, more or less,
mm-hmm.
Made sure I had what I wanted, and it made some of the other kids in the house jealous, in a way.
Sure. Sure, so you learned an adaptation. You know, Wyatt, if you get a chance, what I'd like you to do, you know, if you want to be, if you get home next week at lunchtime and you can be listening in, call my office, leave your phone number, and we'll continue your story, too. I'd like to, because you have a lot to teach us. It's office number, and that's, call me there, 212-757-4488. You could leave your number there. And if you wanted a copy of today's program, which is called The Drama of the Gifted Child Part 2, or last week's program, if you didn't hear it, call that same number, 757-4488. So, Wyatt, I'll be speaking to you shortly, and maybe we'll put you on next week and we go back and review these other ones. We all have time to take a couple of more calls. I want to take a few more calls. Thanks, Wyatt. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. This is Marla.
Hello, Marla.
How are you?
Good.
It's a very interesting topic. Where do I fit in here?
Well, answer the question. Where do you fit in? Did you ever spend any part of your life trying to get people to love you?
Probably the past 48 years.
Just the 48 years, huh? And how's it working? I mean, are you getting it to work? Does it feel like a desperate struggle trying to get the love and approval from everyone around you?
It doesn't work at all.
Yeah, because even if you get it, you know, even if the people who you succeed with now, they're still not the original source,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so all this effort, and I know, you know, you're a kind of out there person, right? You're a person who's more grandiose than you are depressed.
Right.
Right? So you're out there, and people are admiring you and thinking that you're fabulous. You've even been on television, haven't you?
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, you've even been up there and had people look at you and admire you. And there you are, caught in this struggle over and over again. And at some point, Marla's going to say, the way I'm doing it doesn't work. The way I'm doing it, this focus on love and acceptance and approval, it doesn't work. And at one point, as I hear you're at that point right now, you're going to crawl out from under the skin of getting the love and approval and find what Marla is really about.
Right.
You know, and we're going to be talking more about the ways out of this next week, so, you know, be sure to tune in with us.
Okay.
Okay, Marla. 212-279-3400. We're going to take another call. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Hey, Armand. Salem.
Hello, Salem?
Hey.
My gosh, of all people.
Finally got through to you.
Hi there. Have you been calling over the past few weeks?
Not really, but
Talk about one of the out there people. Salem himself has been is one of the great photographers of the universe and a BAI supporter and an honest, holistic person.
Thanks.
Hi there.
Well, you brought something up in one of your talks today, and I was thinking about the relationship that I've been in and the woman that you met me with.
Uh-huh.
And brings up a lot of stuff about similarities in my father.
Who, me or the woman? Or yourself?
Characteristics about her. I've often thought, am I just working out stuff about my dad with her, or is there just...
Well, good, let's speculate with that. Working out what stuff?
Not the closeness with my father when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. What about it?
When you say what about it, I'm not sure.
I mean, did you get close to him, or were you trying to get close to him?
Actually, no. I didn't enjoy his company when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about real young.
And what happened? Why didn't you enjoy his company? Why didn't you like him?
Very loud. He drank. He was most an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
My mom definitely was much closer to me and had more influence in me.
And your mom was closer to you?
Much closer, yeah.
And how did you get her? You know, are you on a remote phone?
Uh-huh.
Salem, you know, sometimes when you get those remote phones, you hear this clicking in and out. So I don't get all of the words.
How's that? Saying.
Oh, that's so much better. Good. So somehow you relate this current relationship and the struggle you have with this current relationship to the struggle you remember with your dad.
Could you? Well, the thoughts come up just because sometimes I just don't feel that close or bonded with the woman I'm seeing. And I then have these feelings about my dad when I was younger. And it's also strange that they have the same birthday.
Oh.
That's just a coincidence.
Yeah, so you might have originally started your relationship with this person, and let's say that you, being one of the people out there...
And you met this person.
Okay, all right. But let's say you're out there and you have this person who you feel this kind of... you might take in as a maternal, nurturing mother. And then after a little while, and this happens with a lot of people, this person who you accepted, this nurturing person, switches over and becomes this other person, the person that you didn't like so much, this dad that you don't like so much, who's not you're really not connected to. You know, and that happens to a lot of folks. Because the truth of it is, the whole battle is a phony battle. The relationship stuff is all acting out something, that the real drama is never really healed, so that the relationships aren't meant to work. They're meant to be something that we keep working in and developing and practicing our skills. But until we get to the stuff that's underneath, it's like, what are we like without a relationship? What's it like to be us without the relationship, without the love quest? Who is that real person? Until we take that on, we're caught in this albatross that Diane described earlier, you know, this kind of endless quest for love, you know?
Well, I'm going to see it then as the other person in our lives can be like, they're just an influence for us to get things together, or they may not be a core of our happiness.
Yeah, I hear, but you're a warrior. You know, it just reminds me of a photograph you once sent me. I know you said about your dad, but it just dawned. I remember one of your famous photographs was a photograph of a man with a big belly who had a drink and a cigarette in his hand. Do you remember that photograph?
Yeah.
Right? That's one of your best photographs, and I can imagine why you took that photograph. That was that part of your dad. Did you ever connect the two?
I'm sure, yeah. Honestly, also what it was representing in a larger picture.
Sure, sure. Nice to talk to you, Sarah.
Thanks again.
Sure, nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, stay well, guy.
Right, bye-bye. Armand DeMille, you're on the air. Hi there, this is Armand.
Hi, Armand, how you doing?
Good, who is this?
My name is Bill, I'm a first-time caller.
Hello, Bill.
And I was just sitting here feeding my son, listening to your program, and a couple of things that you touched on about always wanting to get people to like you really struck me, and it struck me in such a way that I've never even called into a radio station or anything like that, and I don't know, it just, it really, really hit me, it really hit home.
It's something that you feel about you, and you know, and if you think about the beauty of this, look at this, Bill. Here you are in the perfect position to recreate the damage with your child, right? To recreate it, to make the child's creation of themselves conditional on your approval or non-approval, and you're asking the question. And somehow, whoever is up there who puts all these things together, whoever makes this happen, you're listening to a show and you say, boy, this is hitting me on a couple of levels. Myself, Bill, the kid who was always looking for the love and approval in one form or another, and here I am feeding a child.
Right.
You know? And here I am at this perfect moment when I could make a change in life.
Right.
I can make it not the way I was when I was a kid, right, Bill?
Right.
What was it like when you were a kid? Whose approval were you trying to get? Who was the hardest one to get to love you?
See, that's the whole thing. I never really had... I mean, I had approval from both of my parents.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I never really had to... I mean, the approval was always there, but I was always searching for something else, like for my friends to love me. And I joined a fraternity because I wanted those group of guys to love me. And I guess I was just never really honest with myself. And then just listening to your program today, all of a sudden something just really hit me, like, wait a minute, what's going on here? What are you looking for? I think when you asked that question before, when the next time you get to a position where you want somebody to love you, to ask yourself why.
Yeah. You know, I tell you something, Bill. We've got to go, and we've got to get going. It's at the end of the show. Call my office and leave your number, and we'll put you on next week, too. The book, you know, The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, it's a complex book, but really worthwhile. You might pick it up because it might make a real difference to how you deal with your son, but also it might be a chance for you to turn things around for yourself.
All right.
This is Armand DeMille. I want to thank all of you for attending to this. I will be back with you next week, Wednesday at 1 p.m. to continue this. We'll be talking about grandiosity, depression, and this incredible thing called the narcissistic wound. If you want a copy of today's program or last week's, the beginning of the series, 212-757-4488. I'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye for now.